From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. President Biden is turning his attention to infrastructure. Next week, he'll unveil his big plan to improve the country's roads, bridges, and internet capability.
And he indicated in his first news conference yesterday that other pressing issues like immigration, reform, and gun control will have to wait for now.
Successful presidents better than me have been successful in large part because they know how to time what they're doing, order it, decide in priorities what needs to be done.
Let's talk about all of this with our Friday Politics Roundtable. We have Beth Fooey. She is NBC's senior politics editor. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
And Tolu Olorunipa is a political investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome, Tolu. Tolu,
hello.
Are you there? Yes. Hi. I'm going to start with you. So Biden said yesterday that politics is all about timing,
right,
and Republicans need to get on board with him on his agenda because he has support from Republican voters. How is that going over in Washington? And we have a big delay here with you, Tolu. My apologies there. I'm going to go. Yeah, I'm going to go to Beth. Beth, you know, we were talking about the timing that Biden said that we're in right now and that Republicans need to get on board with this agenda because he has support from Republican voters. How do you think that's going over in Washington?
Well, President Biden makes a good point that despite this just sort of rock-ribbed opposition by Republican lawmakers in Washington against the $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan and some of the other things that he has indicated he is interested in, the polling does show that there is broad support for government intervention on a lot of major areas, including, of course, COVID. That's really the only way we're going to get out of this pandemic is for large-scale federal spending, both on vaccines and also on economic relief, but also moving on to other things like infrastructure, which has consistently polled very well among Republicans, Democrats, and independents. So President Biden is correct in that even if Washington is not coming his way, Washington Republicans are not coming his way, he at least at this point does have the support of voters, and that's why he's going to continue marching forward on his path.
Well, Beth, is it surprising to you, though, that after these two horrific mass shootings in the span of a week, Biden does not seem to be putting his own political capital behind something like gun control legislation?
Well, he did say that this is all about timing, and he doesn't believe that the timing is right at the moment for gun control legislation. I don't think he ruled it out. He simply is saying that he's going to stick with the things that he campaigned on, which were COVID relief, economic relief, infrastructure, and then he will get to other things that are pressing Democratic concerns and public concerns eventually. I mean, obviously, that's not going to please a lot of progressives. I mean, there are other issues that they want him to be jumping on immediately as well, including things like voting rights. That he you know, talked about that issue yesterday. He said that what was going on in certain states to restrict voting access is, he called it sick, and he called it a remnant of Jim Crow. But nonetheless, he is staying on message that right now it's all about COVID relief and infrastructure for him, and then he will get to other things after that.
The Post's Tolu Olorunipa is back with us now. And Tolu, I want to come to you and dig in on this infrastructure bill that we expect the president to unveil next week. It's already being described as one of the most ambitious Democratic agendas in decades, reportedly some $3 trillion. And it includes some things Republicans like, roads, bridges, and the like, but it also has extras like free community college, a green electrical grid, changes to the tax code. Where are GOP lawmakers coming down on this?
Well, it's looking like it's unlikely that this broad package is going to get much Republican support. As Beth said, this is the kind of package that Biden campaigned on. This is not only the roads and bridges and fixing things that have bipartisan support, but broad Democratic progressive ideas like, you know, making sure that people have money to go to college, making sure that their child tax credit is permanent, and, you know, anti-poverty measures that aren't necessarily popular within the Republican Party, that, you know, casts itself as a small government party, personal responsibility ideals and things like that. So I don't expect a broad package to get bipartisan support. So far, Biden has had trouble getting Republicans on board with his agenda, even with the pandemic relief program that he put together. And some Republicans said that they were in support of the idea of having some kind of governmental response to the pandemic, but they did not support the $1.9 trillion. So now that we're talking about maybe $3 trillion, it's unlikely that this is going to get much Republican support, if any. But Biden seems determined to go ahead because this is what he campaigned on, and this is really his shot to do something through budget reconciliation, which is sort of this arcane process. But he only has a couple of opportunities to use this. Otherwise, he's going to have to get 60 votes in the Senate and get some Republican support. And right now, it doesn't seem like there is for this. So it looks like he's going to go with the Democrat-only approach, only having members of his own party supporting this package and trying to see how much he can do with only 51 votes.
Right. It's a tough spot because there's only so many things he can pass that has to be related to the budget to go through the reconciliation process. It may be hard to get this whole package through a filibuster, which came up during the news conference. Tolu, I know you were in the room when there was an interesting exchange related to the filibuster. CNN's Caitlin Collins asked the president whether he thought that the filibuster is a relic of the Jim Crow era. Let's take a listen to that exchange.
Why not abolish it if it's a relic of the Jim Crow era?
Successful electoral politics is the art of the possible.
So an interesting exchange there, Beth Fooey, because the president is saying, yes, he does think the Jim Crow era relic applies to the filibuster, and yet he's not ready to do away with it entirely. What did you make of that?
Well, number one, President Biden can't do away with the filibuster. It would have to be done in the Senate. But obviously, his opinion on this and whether or not he's going to decide to press Democratic leaders in the Senate on this is very key. And what I heard him say yesterday is that, no, he really is not inclined to do it at the moment. He sort of seemed to describe it or liken it to almost a nuclear option at the beginning of a process rather than letting the process get itself out and then maybe coming to a different decision once we see where things go with respect to his legislative priorities and whether or not the filibuster really does jam him up. So I didn't hear him rule it out entirely. He clearly knows that many of the things that he needs to do or based because of what he campaigned upon will stall forever in the Senate if this filibuster is preserved. But he is going to let the process play itself out before he makes that big decision on whether or not to say that he would like to see it go away.
Tolu, we heard Beth a little bit earlier talking about the voting rights legislation, but can Democrats get voting rights legislation passed in Congress without getting rid of the filibuster? I mean, last night we saw the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, sign into law this sweeping rewrite of election rules there that would limit voting access. And Democrats in Congress are trying to pass a law to counter those kinds of Republican changes at the state level. Is there legislation going to go anywhere in the Senate?
There does not seem to be the kind of bipartisan support that you would need to overcome the filibuster for voting rights legislation. So it does seem like there are two choices for Democrats and for the Biden administration, which is to try to use what they call as a reform of the filibuster, which essentially would cause them to get rid of the filibuster for this kind of, you know, democracy supporting legislation in their view, and moving forward with only 50 votes. Or not doing anything and essentially realizing that there aren't the votes necessary to get the kind of voting rights legislation that a lot of Democrats want. It does appear that they have to make that choice. So far, it seems like the choice that seems to be the one that is winning out is not doing anything. And, you know, it seems like Biden has not tried to put all of his political capital behind the idea of getting rid of the filibuster in order to pass voting rights legislation. You know, people like Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, a Democrat there, has said that he believes that any voting rights legislation needs to be bipartisan. So even if they did get rid of the filibuster, it's not clear that all 50 Democrats are on board with the idea of passing the voting rights legislation as it stands right now in Congress. So this could be a very tough political fight for the Biden administration. And it's part of the reason why they are talking about the art of the possible and focusing on things like infrastructure and focusing on things like the budget reconciliation package, the $3 trillion Build Back Better plan that they believe they can actually get done while not spending as much political capital on the things that may not get done and would be just political defeats for them. So it does appear that the filibuster is standing in the way of voting rights legislation, and it doesn't appear that there is the political will from either the Biden administration or even within the Democratic caucus in the Senate to get rid of the filibuster for this legislation. And we'll have to wait and see to see what happens if the Republicans decide to vote down this legislation, whether Democrats move on to a plan B or get closer to getting rid of the filibuster, or whether they just decide to move on and focus on what Biden calls the art of the possible.
That's Tolu Olarunipa, a political investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Also with us was Beth Fooey, NBC senior politics editor. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.
Millions of Americans heard Amanda Gorman recite her moving poem, "The Hill We Climb," at President Biden's inauguration on January 20th.
When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace.
Her poignant delivery and passionate words also captivated audiences abroad, leaving international publishers clamoring to get her into print, which in turn meant choosing international translators. By one count, the poem has now been translated into 17 languages. All of the translators approved by Gorman herself. So it came as a surprise when one translator, a white non-binary person in the Netherlands, quit after criticism that they did not share Gorman's skin color or life experiences. A second translator, a white man translating in Catalan, also was let go for the same reasons. The controversy has created factions in the translation world. And let's bring in linguist John McWhorter. He's a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University to talk more about this issue. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya.
Let's go back to the beginning of this controversy. It began when a Black Dutch style writer for an online site argued that it was incomprehensible that a translator who was not a spoken word artist, a young female, and unapologetically Black was chosen to translate her poem. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I think that crucially, the main trait in that description, the one that all of this hinges on, is the color of Amanda Gorman's skin. And this complainant's idea is that it's incontrovertible, that there's no controversy over the idea that the defining trait of Amanda Gorman is that she's Black and may have had experiences of racism in her encounters with white people. And she certainly is Black, and she certainly may have had those encounters. But the idea that that part of her should determine who gets to translate her poetry is very interesting, because we don't have that conversation when thinking about all the other facets of people and how they may not match up between, say, the poet and their translator. There's a sense that when it comes to Black people's relationship with white people, then all bets are off, and suddenly we can't imagine that person's artistic statement being rendered in another language appropriately by someone who isn't of her color and hasn't had those particular kinds of experiences. I find that a dehumanization of her.
A dehumanization of Amanda Gorman.
I do, because I know that these days we're being taught that it's a kind of higher wisdom, that the essence of American society is white people's mistreatment of Black people, and that therefore the essence of being a Black person, such as myself, is your mistreatment at the hands of whites and how you mentally grapple with it. That is a proposition, and it's one that I find extremely reductive of the entire human beings that we are. And I think too many of us Black people are encouraged to have this reductive sense of ourselves. And by the way, Amanda Gorman is not one of them. She's not the one who called for the Dutch translator to pull out.
Right. She actually approved this Dutch translator. But let's take a step backward and talk a little bit about what translators are actually trying to do, because it's not like transcribing a trial. There's so much that relies on interpretation. As Nuria Barros, who translated the poem in Spanish, says, it's about imagination and conveying concepts, not so much being stuck in the confines of individual words. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very important because what Barros is saying is that we're talking about art much more than some sort of mechanical transliteration of exactly what the other person said. And one thing that we can imagine an artist might be good at is putting themselves into the heads and souls of other people. And so the whole idea that there's going to be some sort of mistranscription, as if we were talking about how DNA replicates itself in somebody who's not like Amanda Gorman translating Amanda Gorman, is extremely unartistic. The whole discussion that we're having about all of this is one that seems to quietly call on us to fashion a sort of studied numbness to what art is in favor of acknowledging that we know that racism exists.
But more on what you're saying here, Barros actually wrote this scathing editorial in El País saying that the criticism over who translates ignores some central tenets of translation, like the literary quality of the work produced, and that the goal is to become invisible as the translator and embrace all voices, in effect dissolving themselves and being reborn into others. That is what you're saying, is like aspiring to try to understand so you can translate. But is that really possible?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, some people will be better at it than others. But then notice that in this whole debate, we're being asked to pretend that the measure of being good at it is being able to channel the very particular experience of a black person experiencing racism at the hands of whites. That's one of about 1,000 things that might happen to a black person that might constitute a black person's soul. And in general, you can ask whether a person can subsume themselves into another person's soul in that way successfully. But then, on the other hand, we can also say this. A person's soul is certainly not the slights they may have experienced from white people or the fact that they sense that white people don't see them as completely whole.
Hmm. I mean, also what I'm hearing from you, I mean, does this also kind of speak to this idea that there needs to be multiple translations of works? Is that part of the solution? We see that with other translations of works. There have been multiple interpretations of a work to let various translators express their vision of it.
You know, that would be really interesting because then if you had, say, the old white guy does a translation and then the hip, young, black, spoken word woman does a translation, you could see the differences. And not only would you just have interesting differences in translations like you have interestingly different translations of Shakespeare, but we could actually evaluate, is it true that likeness of life experience when it comes to the issue of racism makes a translation better?
Nuria Barrios, the translator that I mentioned earlier, worries that this type of censorship could be lethal for translation. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that because the truth is that in many countries, for example, there just aren't that many translators of color. And you can say that that isn't right. You can say that that isn't fair, but that leaves it true. And so it means that sometimes there really might not be somebody who's appropriate according to these metrics that we're coming up with, or it might be, and I know we're not supposed to say this, but it might be that the person or two who are available are transparently not as qualified to wield the art of the translation of poetry as various other people who've been doing it for a living or as a lifetime avocation. I've frankly heard that that's the case in one country where I'm sure this exact same thing is about to happen. Going forward, I think that we need to realize that it's not wrong to seek a translator who's had the same kinds of life experiences. It should be one of many metrics that come into play. But the idea that you turn down somebody in late middle age who's translated all sorts of things, including ones having to do with race and racism, because they're not somebody who themselves is black and hasn't suffered racism in the sense that the poet has, that's just too simplistic.
Professor McWhorter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
That's linguist John McWhorter on the controversy over translations of inaugural poet Amanda Gorman's poem, The Hill We Climb.
The attack in a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado, Monday was the third Denver-area shooting in the past 2 decades in which 10 or more people died. And survivors say there's a cumulative effect of so many shootings. Colorado Public Radio's Nathaniel Miner reports.
It was an all-too-familiar sight. Some of the state's top officials gathered to remember victims of a mass shooting.
This cannot be our new normal.
Joe Neguse is the congressman from Boulder.
We should be able to feel safe in our grocery stores. We should be able to feel safe in our schools, in our movie theaters, and in our communities.
More than 36 people were killed between the Columbine High School massacre in 1999, the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012, and the Boulder King Super shooting this week. And the area has seen other shootings at schools and other public places, too. Two died at Platte Canyon High School in 2006, 5 in Arvada and Colorado Springs in 2007, 3 at a Thornton Walmart in 2017. And those can all feel like mass shootings happen more often here. And a Denver Post analysis of shootings since Columbine says that's true. The Denver Metro had the third most mass shootings per capita.
What it does to the community is it shatters their comfort zone. You know, things that used to be inside of our comfort zone are no longer in there.
John Nicoletti is a police psychologist based in Lakewood, Colorado. He says people here need to adapt by doing things like thinking about where all the exits are when they enter a building.
It's kind of like, you know, skiing. Years ago, none of us wore helmets. Now everybody wears helmets. You adapt and you carry on.
Survivors of past shootings have learned how to live with their trauma. Heather Martin was a senior at Columbine High School in 1999. She says therapy and other survivors have helped her over the years, although new shootings can feel like a setback. She's now a high school English teacher in suburban Denver.
I go to school and I feel unsafe for a couple weeks. Like, I have to like resettle in and refigure things out because I've been like triggered. It's been like reignited, if you will, like that anxiety.
Martin helps run a nonprofit called the Rebels Project that connects survivors of mass shootings across the world. Her organization will step in if and when Boulder survivors and family members ask. In the meantime, Martin has this advice for anyone feeling traumatized right now.
Don't minimize your trauma because you think someone else had it worse. Your trauma is yours and your experience is yours.
Martin says that holds true for direct survivors of a shooting, people who saw the images on TV, and even people who've endured more than a year of a global pandemic. In short, she says, just about everyone. For Here and Now, I'm Nathaniel Miner in Denver.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just catch you up on the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, whether it's how to tackle the challenges that come with pregnancy during a pandemic or how to understand the crisis unfolding along our southern border. We'll fill you in for 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
The office-sharing company WeWork is trying again to go public after its first attempt in 2019 failed. And this time, WeWork is skipping the traditional IPO process. Instead, it plans to get on the Nasdaq stock exchange by selling itself to a firm that's already trading there, a kind of business known as a special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC. Virgin Galactic, DraftKings, and Opendoor are among the slew of companies that have gone public by merging with SPACs in the past year. For more on this Wall Street trend, let's turn to Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Callum.
So can you just tell us a bit more about what a SPAC is and how it can be used as an alternative to the more familiar initial public offering process?
Right. So SPACs are often called blank check companies. And the reason is the basic idea is they are publicly traded shell companies that raise money from investors with the goal of then going out and finding a private company to buy and control using that money they raised. And they've become really popular this year. In fact, more than 400 SPACs were announced in North America so far this year. And Callum, to give you an idea of how many that is, that's more than the previous two full years combined already in 2021.
Wow. So I was trying to understand why there's been this uptick. And so I mentioned earlier that the sports betting service DraftKings used a special purpose acquisition company to go public last year. And so I asked the CEO, Jason Robbins, about that move. And he told me merging with a SPAC that's already on a public stock exchange is attractive in this volatile pandemic period.
I think if we had been considering a traditional IPO, it's possible we would have decided that now wasn't the right time. But, you know, the stock itself, because it's a SPAC, has been publicly trading the whole time. So we could tell based on how the stock was trading, you know, where the market was at. It was basically like having a continual measuring stick out there.
So, Mike, if we apply this measuring stick principle to WeWork, that there's this SPAC that's buying WeWork. It's called BOEX Acquisition Company. And even before the deal closes, investors can think of BOEX stock as kind of a proxy for WeWork. And that's going to help WeWork get a sense of what investors think about it. So is a SPAC a safer way to go public for a company like WeWork that had a pretty spectacular failure in its IPO attempt a couple years ago?
Yeah, right. When it comes to a company like WeWork, it's very, very difficult to come back from a failed IPO such as theirs and try to do it again. So I think there's an argument that this was probably their best, possibly their only real viable option to go public. I think for other companies, this type of deal is appealing because take a company like DraftKings. They might not have a lot of experts in-house who have experience taking a company public and raising money in the capital markets. So this is sort of an appealing way to do that. It's in order to not have to bring in executives who know how to do this and bring in investment banks and hire them. I mean, there's obviously still investment banks involved, but this is a much simplified process compared to the traditional route to going public if you're the CEO of a company that it gets purchased by a SPAC.
Sure, good point. Jason Robbins, the CEO, part of the founding team there, so maybe not a trader by trade, an attractive option. And I guess we'll have to see whether this is a pandemic trend or whether it continues beyond this acute phase. That's Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Colin.
Here is some music that seems to fit the moment we're in right now. It's a waltz by the 20th century Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich, intended to invoke jazz music, which became part of his suite for variety orchestra. And here to explain why it's the perfect listen right now is our music opinionator, Fran Hoffner. Hi, Fran.
Hi, Callum. How's it going?
It's going well. So this isn't exactly new music, but why is it on your playlist right now?
You know, I have been a longtime Shostakovich fan. I really love his symphonies and I listen to them a lot, but his music is often very serious. And even when it's not serious, it's satirical. And I was sort of stumbling through some of the more modern Shostakovich pieces. And this suite I thought was really fun and really surprising. And I think the times we live in right now are starting to become fun and surprising again.
Yeah, there's that renewed sense of optimism as we get into spring and the vaccines are rolling out. But I think that what you're hinting at is that it's sort of surprising for Shostakovich because we know that he had a hard life in a lot of ways. I mean, he survived the brutal purges of Stalinist Russia. He fell in and out of favor in that country. And there's always this raging debate about whether he was a loyal communist or a sellout or a closet dissident. He's someone you've studied closely. What do you make of him?
You know, I think he was someone just trying to survive with whatever moment he happened to be in. I guess maybe that comes closer to sellout than dissident, but he's someone who had a really illustrious career despite two denunciations. And the fact that he has these really sort of jazzy waltzes to go along with his more political, serious music, I think speaks to how prolific he was.
I like that term, jazzy waltzes. The music is kind of edgy. And another reason I think it's sort of relevant right now is we're having this conversation in music right now about how you even categorize different styles. There's such blurring of lines. And we see that right here decades ago. The music is kind of hard to categorize, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't exactly feel like what we think of as classical music. It doesn't really feel like Russian classical music. There's a Westernness, there's almost an Americanness to it. I think it's sort of mischievous. The waltz makes, when I listen to it, I feel like I'm getting away with something. What that is, I don't know, but I wonder if he felt that way too.
It makes it kind of a fun sensibility. And in a way, he was trying to get away with something because Stalin banned jazz music in Russia in 1932. How did he and other composers work around that?
Stalin didn't want jazz from America being played in the USSR, but I think homegrown jazz was sort of allowed, or you could do what Shostakovich did, which is write something for a variety orchestra, or he has another suite for jazz orchestra, and that takes all the instruments that we associate with a symphony orchestra, your strings, your brass, but it adds a lot more modern instrumentation. So often there's saxophone, there's vibraphone, there's xylophone, a lot more fun woodwinds and percussion to really round out the color of it all.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of it because it is a lot of fun. There is some what I could call ta-da showiness to the music. And this suite begins with a march. Let's take a listen. So, Fran, here I feel like I'm listening to something by John Philip Sousa. What do you hear in that? It's not really actually what we think of as jazz in the classic American sense.
No, it feels a little more formal and militaristic, but there's that xylophone in there that feels kind of funny and fun. And the way that you said it's Sousa-like makes me think that he's almost doing like an imitation of what he thinks this kind of music should sound like. It's just sort of one beat off. Feels slightly askew.
And when you say that there's some satire in his music, what do you mean by that? Who's he poking fun at?
Oh, he would certainly always be poking fun at the government, the administrations, the bureaucracy. When he returned after his first denunciation with his Fifth Symphony, he maintained in his autobiography and so on that this was like a satirical symphony. It was making fun of those in power by having the triumphant parts feel almost too triumphant, too overconfident. And I think this march is almost a little too whimsical to be exactly militaristic. It's too playful to be a representative of, you know, the greatness of Russian culture.
All right, well, let's listen to a little bit more of it because it is an awful lot of fun. I want to underscore a piece of this that has what I would say is almost a circus-like feel. Take a listen. So, Fran, there's just this restless energy here. It's kind of a funny-sounding dance, actually. What does it evoke for you as a listener?
Oh, there's so much razzle-dazzle to this. It's very funny to me, and as a former percussionist, I can't help but always hone in on whatever percussion is there, so I'm thinking, like, wow, what a great tambourine part this must be for someone just to dance along with the orchestra.
The names of these different sections of the suite, march, waltz, polka, they are dances. Were people actually supposed to get up and move instead of just sitting and listening?
Probably not. I think that adds to some of the mischief of it, because the music is tempting. It's like, get up, enjoy this. But that's not exactly, you know, how we're supposed to behave when we see the orchestra.
I see. Tempting you to get out on the dance floor when, in fact, the rules are to actually sit still and just listen. I mentioned the polka a little bit ago, and I do want to take a listen to that. This is probably one of the most fun movements of this jazz suite. All right, Fran, you're the percussionist, so I know that you're appreciating that xylophone there.
Oh, yeah. That seems like a very difficult part, but one in which, of course, I'm once again envious of the percussionist who gets to play it. But it's a very modern polka. I think we think of polkas as being from, 75 to 100 years prior. We think of Strauss. We think of Strauss II. Those are very theatrical polkas, and this is almost, like, really laid back. This is just a laid-back polka.
And so this xylophone that you're so fond of comes back at the end of the suite in the finale. So, Fran, this is an awfully fun way to send the audience out after the end of a performance. What do you think Shostakovich is going for there?
I think there's an undeniable sharpness to that finale and a really memorable little tune, especially played on that xylophone. I think what's always compelled me about the xylophone is that it doesn't mesh in with the sound of the orchestra very well. It doesn't blend. It always kind of cuts above the strings, the brass, just because of the nature of the sound that it makes. And so you listen to it and you're just immediately humming it. That's the little melody that you carry out with you into the lobby, into the night, after you hear this at the symphony.
You know, just to bring this music back to the current moment, I know that you've written very affectionately about the composer, Colin Shostakovich, your little nervous guy. And I guess we're all a little nervous right now during the pandemic, although there is that hint of optimism, as we discussed earlier. But why does this music speak to you in this moment?
I think this Suite for Variety Orchestra reminds me that there's more to Shostakovich than his political music and his, you know, denunciations and his comebacks. I'm very inclined, even as a fan of his, to reduce him to, you know, only the capital I important music that he did, and that he also did fun music and lively music and film scores is something that I forget. And I think it's perfect for this moment because it's very easy to essentialize the most important thing that's happening and completely ignore something joyful. So it's a reminder to feel joy and mischief during a time when we maybe feel guilty for doing so.
Yeah, a reminder that we could all use right now. So thank you for bringing us the lighter side of Shostakovich. That's Fran Hoffner. She is Here and Now's music opinionator. Thanks, Fran. This was fun.
Thank you.
A year into the pandemic, we're reflecting on the ways it has disrupted life collectively and individually. And for the last year, many of the interactions we've had with other human beings outside our pods is over Zoom. We have our meetings on Zoom, we have cocktails and go to school online. It's one of the new features of our lives, and now deaths. Virginia Prescott from Georgia Public Broadcasting learned that firsthand.
2,869 Americans died from COVID-related deaths on December 18th of 2020. My mother, Patricia Healy Prescott, was one of them. She was 94, a widow with Alzheimer's, mother to 11 children, grandmother, great-grandmother. Everyone knew her as Patsy. As COVID deaths go, we were lucky to be with my mom when she died at my sister's home in coastal Massachusetts. We cobbled together an online memorial on the kind of bracingly cold New England day that makes you wonder how early settlers survived.
Hey, everybody. It's Virginia. Here with
that
you.
Fear hovered over us as the COVID death toll climbed day by day.
So glad you're all with us this evening. And
there were a few inexperienced Zoomers.
Screen, there is a little microphone.
The volume.
And, of course, some bungles.
We should probably stay muted.
She couldn't get on, so she can see you and she can hear you.
Hi, I tried my best to be with you.
But no priest, no service, none of the sandwich plates and meandering toasts our Irish Catholic family is accustomed to. Instead, an array of poorly lit but familiar faces taking part in a ritual as old as humankind itself.
There is a hunger and an appetite to grieve and mourn, and I think we're actually biologically wired in a way that grieving is an essential part of the human experience. When someone dies, it leaves a tremendous hole in our lives, and we need to fill that hole.
That's Barry Koch, co-founder of TG Beyond, which helps families navigate late and end-of-life needs. Since COVID hit, the bulk of his work is producing online memorials. And despite the incalculable loss of shared hugs and casseroles, he's discovered an informality rarely seen at in-person events.
What we're finding is somebody taping a testimonial in the comfort of their own home. They're a lot more willing and able to share intimate and meaningful stories, as opposed to somebody who has to walk to the front of a church in front of 200 people in a blue suit or heels and deliver a meaningful, intimate, you know, address to a group of people.
Some families are delaying memorials until they can be together in person. We certainly never imagined honoring my mother's life via Zoom, but it felt urgent to mark her loss while the embers of grief were still hot.
It's been a really difficult time staying down here in Florida and
having to watch my sisters take care of my mom. I wish I was there. I wish I could have helped you.
Grammy, she showed how I should treat my wife and my sisters and my daughter.
I wondered at first how we'd fill 90 minutes.
Does anybody want to share? I'm not seeing, maybe you're seeing some hands raised. I'm not so far.
But one by one, memory by memory, we gave each other a little more courage to speak, and a life of devotion and derring do emerged. And for the whole time we gathered, Patsy felt a little more with us.
Sure, I wasn't planning on speaking, but I'm like, I have to honor what she's done for the grandkids.
Your mom, about 8 months pregnant, doing flips off the diving board while visiting us.
That she just hopped onto the diving board and did a backflip, like out of nowhere. And I can remember thinking, how does she do that? She had 11
you
children.
You kind of stole my story about mom with the jumping off the bridge and so forth.
Sorry, Mark.
And as she would wish, there was music.
One, two, three, four. Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
There were my parents dancing to Fats Waller on the morning of their 60th anniversary. And there we were, singing Christmas carols at her bedside in her last days.
Glory to God.
And then my nephew Nick playing Amazing Grace on his fiddle. Maybe we go back to grieving in person together once we're all vaccinated. But doing it in 2D after months of isolation felt surprisingly rich and comforting. All of those conversations normally overheard at a wake or shiva came together in one place, a computer screen, to tell stories about a life that began when the radio felt like magic. And it was magic, a COVID-inspired adaptation allowing us to mourn together, apart. For Here and Now, I'm Virginia Prescott in Atlanta.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.